morning, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs to order. It is now 8:08 a.m. on Thursday, March 21st in Capitol Room 106. Apologies for the delay. We've had some slight technical difficulties this morning. If you're here with us in the room, there are printouts of the presentations just outside the Room 106 door. This morning, members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Kopp, Representative Lincoln, Representative Ortez, and myself, Representative Zilkuski Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. We would ask everyone to take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you in advance. Before we begin, I would like to thank Tribal Affairs Committee aide Grace Singh, Julia Bushman, the Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges, the Juno LIO from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We're going to begin today's hearing on the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact with a telephonic presentation on tribal law and jurisdiction from Tammy Giroux, the Executive Director of the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. Ms. Giroux, please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. My name is Tammy Truitt Giroux. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center.
Thank you. Please begin.
All right, and then I'll go ahead. I'm going to try to do this if someone is moving forward the slides, but I'll just do a brief introduction of myself. My name is Tammy, and I have a bachelor's degree, and my education is a bachelor's degree in social work, community psychology master's work, and a secondary education certificate. I have lived in the village of, and am enrolled in the village of Anvik on the lower Yukon River. And I have been, my experience is that I have worked as both the tribal administrator, the ICWA social worker, and many other capacities in the community for over 27 years. I taught school, but I also, I think the piece that is possibly the most helpful was that I was also, my husband was the tribal chief for over 27 years. And firsthand, I can tell you that the response by him and other people on the council was on a daily basis. We oftentimes would get calls in the middle of the night, and he would respond to numerous types of needs. And normally, unfortunately, it was a crisis of some kind, whether that was a search and rescue operation or a sudden death that was suspicious or a child that needed some help. I kept rolled up sleeping bags in my living room and mats, and at any given time, I would get my children up to go to school, and there would be people camping on our living room floor. So all of those experiences combined have gone into this presentation. And the reason that I show this picture on the front of this presentation is that on the left, and it may not be your left, but it's my left, the old grandmas that are standing on the hill on the Bonneville River are directly related to these little boys that are also in a boat right below the hill on the Bonneville River that we were going up to their culture camp. And so the direct correlation of the land and the people and the community is extremely strong, and so our ancestors have meaning. And I think that's important when we start talking about any kind of tribal affairs and or tribal authority. If you go to the next slide, I'm sure that many of you have seen this language map. And the language map really is just a demonstration of the fact that in Alaska, we have 229 of the federally recognized tribes out of the 573 federally recognized tribes in the United States. That's over 40% of the tribes. That's a great deal of tribal experience that is here in the state, and I think that's something actually we can be proud of. And as you can see from the language map, of course, we are all distinct. We have distinct language groups with distinct culture and distinct ways that we live. Even though there are similarities, we have to be aware and and careful that we also acknowledge that there are differences. So going on to the next slide, and I'm going fast, but I know that you have other people that are going to present, and I just want to give you a brief overview. And please interrupt me at any time, and I would be happy to try to answer your questions. It's a little awkward not being able to see you, so I'll try to be mindful of that.
You're doing great, and we have someone advancing the slides, so please continue.
All right. The next slide, number... So unfortunately, the other thing about Alaska and tribal Alaska and rural Alaska, but also in the cities, is that we also have the highest rate of violence against Alaska Native women and people anywhere else in the United States. And of course, I have to bring that up because that's the kind of work that I do. I also have 40 years experience working in the field of domestic violence and sexual assault, unfortunately. And so these are the kind of things, statistics that we don't necessarily want to own, but they do belong to us, unfortunately. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I'll try to answer that really briefly as we go on. So going on to the next slide, I'm very passionate about the idea of sovereignty, not just in terms of our tribal sovereignty, but there's three sovereigns in the United States, of course. And there's the United States, and there's the state of Alaska, and then there's tribal sovereignty. And all of the principles of sovereignty apply to that. But in this case, when we talk about tribes, we talk about the idea of inherent sovereignty, that it's not just something that is given, but it's a part of who the identity of the group of people. And so as a tribe, that's the identity. It's an inherent right. Health, safety, and political integrity is a sovereign principle. Community health and survival, again, whether that's through a state entity or a federal entity or a tribal entity. Unfortunately, it's also, there's a high rate of violence, and again, there's some underlying root causes of that. And unfortunately, the state system has not been adequate to meet some of the needs of the tribal system in Alaska. Immediate and local response is also a principle of sovereignty. And so I also have and I think that we have to take self-responsibility in order to help keep our citizens accountable. That's also part of the work of a sovereign. Immediate and local response, it's self-determination and safety, children and culture, traditions, and language. And oftentimes when we talk about language, we have to really take that a little deeper than just speaking a different language or our native language. Because there's a lot of language is an intricate way of understanding, and it also is tied very directly into identity. Because oftentimes language has meanings that are much different than just, for instance, an English hello. And so, again, it's tied into a sovereign or a cultural belief system. And I'm moving really fast, but I want to also talk about, and I know that many of you all know this already, but I think it's a really important issue when we start talking about jurisdictional issues, particularly in the state of Alaska. Public Law 280 has some major implications to tribal Alaska. And the reason why is that Public Law 280 impacts six different states, and Alaska is the reason that the impact in Alaska is a little different from those other states, of course, has to do with some other jurisdictional pieces. But Public Law 280 did do, and that was on the first, I hopefully somebody's advancing the slide there, eliminates most but not all of the federal criminal jurisdiction in Indian Country. And Indian Country itself has, there's federal jurisdiction on laws that are felonies or laws that are basically not misdemeanors in most of reservations and other things. And that's a whole another host of things that probably we're not going to get into here. But it authorized states to apply their statewide criminal laws to Indian Country to eliminate, states to apply their statewide criminal laws in Indian country to Indians and non-Indians. So across the board. It didn't matter what land you were on. PL 280 gave authorization for the states to apply their statewide criminal laws. It opened up state courts, private suits against Indians arising out of Indian country. It authorized states, not tribes, to return or retrocede their jurisdiction back to the federal government. Again, that's a whole another area that, and moving on to the next slide, it eliminates most but not all the federal criminal jurisdiction in Indian country, authorized states to apply their statewide criminal laws in Indian country to Indians and non-Indians, opened the state courts to private suits against, I already said that, didn't I? That was a repeat. It was a nice picture, though. sorry about that. Let's see here.
I do want to take a moment, Ms. Giroux, I do want to take a moment to recognize that Vice Chair Edgeman and Representative Vance have both joined us. Please continue.
Thank you. But going on to the next slide, what PL 280 did not do, and this is really critical, really, for our purposes, is authorize states to exercise jurisdiction over trust lands, authorize states to exercise jurisdiction over federally protected hunting and fishing rights, eliminate pre-existing tribal jurisdiction. And again, I am not a legal person. I am, and so that's not an argument that I can get into. These are just the facts from the law. But then we move to the next slide, which talks about the whole definition of Indian country, which is where it gets a little problematic in Alaska, being that 228 of the tribes in Alaska are not designated as Indian country, only Metlakatla. But Indian country is defined at 18 U.S.C. 1151. Public Law 280 impacts Indian country. And the Venati decision in 1998, it changed the designation in Alaska for any Indian country. ANCSA changed things in Alaska as well. Again, most native lands do not constitute Indian country. Therefore, PL 280 is a largely irrelevant, is what has been believed, and the exceptions are the allotments and trust lands. Again, this is a whole nother legal area that is not my expertise, and it's been argued much higher up than me. So I'm just actually stating out what that looks like when we talk about, jurisdiction. Concurrent jurisdiction is the one thing that did stay in place, and the state of Alaska has concurrent jurisdiction over most of the matters that arise in tribal villages. And that comes from the PL 280. It's concurrent means at the same time. So concurrent jurisdiction means that more than one sovereign entity has power. And concurrent does not mean that the village power is any less than the state power. Well, that's not necessarily true. And I want to just be really upfront about the fact that I have a great deal of respect for the Alaska State Troopers that are in and having to do the job that they do. Understaffed, under-resourced, and they don't have enough manpower to get to all of the communities that need them. I also have a great deal of respect for our village police officer program, our tribal police officer program, and city and or village police officers. I think that that's a missing link in a lot of the work that we do in terms of working either with tribal courts and or state courts. Because if you do not have a response on the ground, you oftentimes cannot then move anything forward, whether that's oftentimes even in a tribal court. And so I want to just say that really clearly up front as we move on. And I'll pause if there's any questions.
I don't see any questions at this time. Please continue.
Okay. The next slide. The most important lesson that we get from this is that Public Law 280 did not eliminate pre-existing tribal jurisdiction. Tribal governments have exercised authority over people and places for thousands of years. Tribal governments can still assert their authority over their members and internal matters. And I think that's the most important piece that we get from a lot of the laws and jurisdictions is that the tribal courts have the authority over their members. They don't necessarily have authority at this point because of those other laws that eliminated the Indian country designation over a land base, which can end up being a bit problematic, especially when you have people coming into communities that are really considered lawless. I mean, you have an attitude in communities. For an example, I'll use Anzac is a really good example of that. All of the years that we, my husband was the chief and I worked as in a lot of the other sectors, especially with the tribal administration, out of those 27 years, there was only law enforcement in the community 5 of those years at various times. We had a couple of times there was a VPSO for a year, not often more than a year. There was a tribal police officer through a federal grant that the tribe had been able to receive. So most of the time, the response for law enforcement was from the Aniak Post, which is also out of the supervised out of the Bethel Post. And so at any given time, weather permitting, if there was a need, you didn't have immediate law enforcement response. And so somebody had to. And that's the truth of it, I think, in a lot of our small communities. It was that when things happen, somebody has to. And oftentimes that's just whoever people trust somewhat in the community. And I think that the unique circumstances in Alaska is that, of course, the Venati decision, which really tied the hands of a lot of tribal jurisdiction. And it did. I mean, that's a fact. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, again, a whole lot of differing opinions on that. ANILCA, again, Alaska National Interest Lands and Conservation Act. And I think the most, the biggest factor is the remote location of a lot of our communities. And that remote location and isolation and accessibility have created a situation where we, I believe, have to be much more creative in how we help our citizens. And so that gets to the next slide, just as a good example of, it really is a good example of the isolation and how we, you know, how we get to where we need to go. And I know that none of you, all of you are aware of that. And one of the major things that I believe that our organization also works with is tribes. Our main, the main people that work with are tribes, and we believe in a tribal and a local community response. But we also think that the community itself knows what they need, and that identity and identifying what they need is what's critical when you hold people accountable. Because as I used it as an example a little while ago, where there hasn't been law enforcement but 5 out of 27 years, that's a whole lot of years that people have nobody that is going to hold them accountable. And oftentimes, if you don't have evidence, then you don't move forward in any kind of prosecution. So oftentimes, people that are doing bad things basically are not being held to a higher standard. And so if you have a local tribal authority that is willing to step in and hold their citizens to a higher standard, that's definitely going to be a plus because the community is going to run smoother. Now, the whole purpose of that is that I really advocate for community, both accountability and response, and I think that tribal courts is a huge piece of that. But I also know that they need resources to do that because, unfortunately, why we have such high numbers of victimization in this state, especially in tribal communities, is because of the disparities that have been in place for many, many years and the lack of resources. And resources being not just money, human capacity building. It's also training. It's also having law enforcement in the communities that can also help enforce tribal code as well as state code and understanding how they can intersect but also the differences. And so I think that there's many, many areas of need, but I also think that we have to really work responsibly and in partnership with the tribal communities that are oftentimes ones that are being able to access funds, whether through federal grants and or other resources, and work with the state to really understand those needs. Now, I don't know if you've heard the stories. We do a lot of work with tribal communities, and the stories we hear and the frustration we get from tribal leadership really has to do, at tribal courts, with really the response and the lack of, I think, respect in some ways of the community's ability to having managed itself with very little for so long. And I heard a question, I think it was from Mr. Edgman, that at the Tuesday hearing about, well, is it drugs and alcohol that's creating most of the problem? And I think drugs and alcohol are a huge problem in rural Alaska, but it goes deeper, and the roots of that are much deeper than just the drugs and alcohol. Drugs and alcohol are a symptom to a bigger problem. And again, there has to be the resources, whether that's helping to get tribes to build an infrastructure within their communities that include healing services, whether that's counseling, whether that's alcohol or drugs, or, recovery, whether that's working with families in terms of trying to keep children in their homes. You know, there's just so many aspects to that that, again, we definitely don't have time to go through all that. But I appreciate your listening to me, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Rue as a result of her presentation? Representative Lincoln.
So with regards to Public Law 280, did that have any implications in terms of opportunities for tribes to get federal funding for law enforcement in the state?
Well, yes, it does. The implications were actually a little bit different than that. The law enforcement issue is kind of there's three or four prongs to that. One is, of course, the jurisdiction and the concurrent jurisdiction, but that really wasn't the biggest issue. The biggest issue is that under where the funding comes for law enforcement is usually through the BIA and also through the COPS DOJ funding. And what's happened is because of the jurisdiction, the lack of Indian country, BIA was not necessarily able to help fund positions in Alaska. And also the COPS funding, we were actually, through Senator Stevens, had put a rider on several years ago on some legislation that impacted tribes being able to access those funds. Now that's changed in recent years, but now where we find ourselves is that tribes can access COPS funding to hire tribal police officers, but tribal police officers have to follow tribal code. And if you don't have, if your tribal code is not in conjunction with state code, it's very difficult. The laws get a little confusing, and there's a lack of training for our COPS positions. I know that the Alaska State Troopers do a two-week training for tribal police officers, but it's very minimal. And I think that there's other tribes in Alaska who have tried to get their tribal police officers into the BIA Academy down in, I think it's in Arizona, New Mexico. And so there's been some roadblocks. And the PL 280 piece roadblock is that the concurrent jurisdiction, the only real overlap that's been available is under VAWA. And VAWA has the protection order piece that helps make sure that through full faith and credit, any protection order that is issued through a tribe can then be administered through any law enforcement agency within the vicinity, whether that's Alaska State Troopers, Tribal Police Officer, VPO, federal and out in the states. So that's kind of a complicated question, but I don't think it's just about that. I think it's the Indian country. I think it's some legislation that's happened in the past, and I also think it's about also the lack of training and also the lack of opportunities and I think going across like with VPSOs and tribal police officers, when you have both in your community, it's a little confusing about which code you can enforce.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Giroux, for your time today, for your dedication to Alaska's tribes, and talking through this with us this morning. So, Guyana.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. We will continue our hearing on the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact with a presentation by Ms. Nicole Borromeo, General Counsel for the Alaska Federation of Natives, and Ms. Natalie Norberg, Director of the Alaska Office of Children's Services. Ms. Borromeo and Ms. Norberg, please come forward, state your name for the record, and begin your presentation.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. My name is Nicole Borromeo, and I serve as the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Alaska Federation of Natives. We're the oldest and largest statewide Native organization in Alaska. We've been around for more than 50 years. We began as an umbrella organization to ensure a fair and just settlement of our land claims, and we've continued on to work on issues of mutual importance to the entire Alaska Native community. I'm originally from McGrath, so I grew up over from our chair here. Representative Zlokalski on the Kuskokwim River. I hold a law degree from the University of Washington, but my proudest degree is actually from Mount Edgecombe High School. And I'm a product of the public school system. From there, I went on to the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And I'm licensed to practice in not only Alaska, but also Hawaii and Washington, as well as on the Tulalip Indian Reservation. Thank you very much again for having me today.
Good morning, Madam Chairman Zlokalski, sorry, and members of the committee. My name is Natalie Norberg, and I'm the Director of the Office of Children's Services, and I appreciate this opportunity to be here this morning. I, too, am from Alaska. I was born and raised here in Southeast Alaska, and it's a privilege to serve my state now in this position. We're going to start with a video that provides a overview of the Tribal Child Welfare Compact, and then we'll get into some slides to provide some more information.
Brief at ease. And we're back on record.
It is time. Our children deserve this. This compact is for them. It's going to change the trajectory of our future. We'll be able to pinpoint this moment in time 15 years from now, 10 years from now, and say this is when it changed. This is when we took control of our own destiny and started to rewrite how our history is going to unfold.
There are many things in the history of the Native people and the tribal community that sent a message to us that as we grew up, that our communities, our governments were not important. And as we moved into adulthood, we struggled with that and feeling like we have a place in our own homeland, so to speak, in our own traditional land and cultures. Advances like this, and having people acknowledge it and recognize our authority and our place, for me, it gives me a sense of coming home, of having a home. There's a freedom that comes. There's a lifting of a burden that comes when important steps like this are made.
We agree to your proposed language change.
Thank you. So the state is ready to close out Article 10.
Yes.
A lot of the emotion in that room was really about, generations of people telling Alaska Native people and Alaska Native leadership that who we were as people wasn't enough. And that's just not true. And I think, you know, it was a recognition of the fact that in our communities, if we have our tradition, if we have our culture, if we have our language, we have enough. We have what it takes to keep our children strong and safe.
We've been trying to think of ways to have the tribes be able to provide the services that they have the inherent right to do so. They have their sovereign nations, and this compact provides them the opportunity to do just that, to provide services to their children and families within their home communities.
Tribes and tribal organizations will always act in the best interest of the tribe. And our tribes are made up of families, extended families, large extended families. So it's our obligation to, as leaders, to create the framework in which to move forward anything, including compacting, as a tool to ensure that our communities are strong. That's really what it means.
We know that Alaska Natives are disproportionately represented when they come into foster care, and then as they go through the foster care system, their outcomes are worse than their non-Native counterparts. So we believe that kids will do better when they're served closest to home, and particularly if they're served by their own tribe or tribal organization. Those families are going to be far more receptive to engagement and to working through those really difficult issues than they are with the state.
What the compact, in my opinion, does is it really empowers tribes to exercise their ability to develop and implement culturally relevant services that really truly meet the needs of our children and families, and really impact how we provide the services.
The Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact is a recognition that Alaska Native culture keeps Alaska Native children safe. This historic agreement, really the first of its kind in the United States, is an agreement between the state of Alaska and Alaska tribes that recognizes the authority of tribes to provide child welfare services in their communities.
Well, this agreement strengthens all Alaskan families because it gives us the opportunity to work more closely with our partners to provide services for kids all across Alaska. And the other thing that this does is it sets a framework for government-to-government agreements with tribes going forward into the future for other potential services besides child welfare services.
I think it's a step in the right direction. Our culture, before we even had the state or the federal government involved in our lives. And the villages worked hard to help support other families. We know we've gone through times of famine and times of abundance, but whenever they have an abundance, they shared with the families in need, and they looked out for each other. So I think in essence, becoming a foster parent is just like going back to the culture of caring for your other children, and especially children that are in need.
So having our children be in that environment where they have regular access to their elders and to their culture, so that one day they can be the elder and hand down our cultures and traditions to the next generation, is vitally important to the Native community. Our culture is the heartbeat of our people. It's what guides us and connects us. Our children deserve better, and we can do better.
before you begin, I'll just take a moment to say, seeing all those images of home makes me slightly homesick. But please continue.
Thank you. Before we get into the compact, I was asked to provide a general overview of the Indian Child Welfare Act, so I'm happy to do that. The Indian Child Welfare Act is a major piece of federal legislation that was passed in 1978. It very much governs the work that we do here in Alaska around child welfare. It was put in place as a response to and a recognition that at that time there were large numbers of American Indian and Alaska Native children being taken into state custody and then being adopted into Caucasian families. And those children were being forever lost to their tribes. So in essence, when you think about it, it was tribal children, tribal citizens being taken away from their tribal nations, and there was nothing that the tribes could do about it. And so to help correct this situation, the act was passed. And what it does is it basically provides more oversight and special conditions and far more scrutiny on Alaska Native and American Indian child cases that come into state child welfare systems. It provides special protections for Indian children, and Indian children are defined as those children who are enrolled or eligible for enrollment in a tribe. It also specifically allows tribes to enter as a legal party in the case, and that allows them to express their interest in the case, which is separate from the parent's interest or the child's interests. One of the important pieces of the act is the requirement for active efforts on a case. Several years ago, the federal government, after the act had been in place for almost 40 years, they provided regulations and more guidance about what exactly active effort means. So now we have some more operationalized examples of what that looks like. And in Alaska, we know that it means that services must be provided to families, not just to the parents of the children, but to the extended family, and everything needs to be done to try to keep that family within their biological family and within their tribal community. So services have to be extended beyond just the parents, and the case planning should involve as many people of the family and the tribe. And services should be provided in the most culturally consistent way possible. Another major piece of the act is the requirement for a hierarchy of placement preferences. States are held to the requirement to make sure that children are first and foremost placed with an Indian child family member, with the Indian child's family member, or in a licensed home approved by the tribe or licensed by the tribe, or an Indian foster home that's approved by the tribe, or an institution that's been approved by a tribe. And then there's no more preferences after that, but I was thinking there was a fifth one. And then for adoptive situations, the first primary preference, of course, would be a family member, an other member of the Indian's tribe, or another Indian family. So we began our work on the compact basically because those of us that have been working in this area recognize that still today, even with the passage of the Indian Child Welfare Act, there are still significant disparities in Alaska's child welfare system for Alaska Native children. Currently, Alaska Native children make up about 23% of the child population in the state of Alaska, and they make up 64% of the kids in foster care. And we know that once they enter into the foster care system, their outcomes tend to be worse. One example of this is the repeat maltreatment rate for Alaska Native children. That rate is 17%, and for their non-Native counterparts, it's 9%. And the national average is 6.8%. So you can see that we have some real problems in Alaska related to maltreatment and repeat maltreatment. So we started this work. We didn't just start it with the compact. There have been long-term relationships going and work, collaborative work happening within the Office of Children's Services and with tribal partners in a informal and informal ways for almost 25 years. This started as a result of tribes being able to draw down federal funds through Title IV-E for child welfare services. And so there are 11 tribes in the state of Alaska, tribes and tribal entities that currently have pass-through agreements to draw down federal funds. Title IV-E is the major federal funding source for child welfare. And through these agreements, tribal entities are able to help build their infrastructure for their own child welfare systems by being able to pay for training and case management and the support services that their caseworkers provide to families in to families that are in the state's child welfare system. So this group came together primarily with partners from the tribes who have existing child welfare programs, and we have been, the Office of Children's Services and those groups have been working on various strategies to try to address disproportionality and to try to ensure that we are, as a state, complying with the Indian Child Welfare Act.
So, in case you're wondering what a compact is, we're going to have a brief tutorial here in federal Indian law. Congress does have plenary power over Indian affairs. This is set out in the U.S. Constitution through the Indian Commerce Clause. So that's what gives the federal government the exclusive right to enter into these types of agreements with tribes, and also they have extended that to states as well. So as a basic principle, a compact is established on sovereignty of federally recognized Indian tribes. Tribes have inherent authority to provide for the health, safety, and welfare of their members, as well as individuals who are eligible for membership in the tribe. The compacting model arose during the self-determination and self-governance era that started in the 1960s. Federal Indian law and policy has been through many different eras. We had an allotment era, a termination era. Those were darker times. We are now in a period of self-determination and self-governance, wherein this federal government really tries to strengthen the inherent governance authority of tribes, and that's the era that we're continuing on today. You saw on the video that the former commissioner, Val Davidson, talked about the compacting model and how this is a first of its kind agreement for the states. That is true. Alaska is really on the edge of law and policy here in negotiating a compact of this nature at the state level. No other state has done something like this before. So we're very proud of the work that has gone into this. A compact is different from a grant, and that's something that it's really important for the committee to understand. This isn't an agreement that the Office of Children's Services and the Department of Health and Social Services came to the different tribal organizations and tribes and said, we would like you to perform X, Y, and Z services for the children that would come into state custody and care in your region. Rather, the tribal organizations and tribes sat down, as you saw on the compact video, and really negotiated what this compact would look like over the course of 10 months. The negotiation schedule was quite aggressive. We came together once, sometimes four times a month, during the negotiation period, and really jointly drafted this compact.
Representative Lincoln has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this might be really technical. I don't know, off the top of your head, but how is eligibility for membership determined, like with the in terms of authority over of tribes over their members or individuals who are eligible for membership?
Thank you for the question, Representative Lincoln, through the chair. Eligibility is determined at the tribal level. All tribes are their own independent sovereign entities. So, for example, the Kotzebue tribe would not determine eligibility memberships for my tribe, for McGrath. At the federal level, though, there is a blood quantum that requirement that's required. So in order to be considered an Indian for purposes of federal benefits, you have to have a blood quantum of 25% or higher. However, tribes have lowered that blood quantum for purposes of enrollment in their services, and that's perfectly permissible. But in order to be considered an Indian for political classification doctrine purposes, there is a blood quantum requirement.
Okay,
follow up.
So Native Village of Kotzebue, we accept tribal members from different tribes or backgrounds. I mean, Native Village of Norvik, people with no Indian blood or Alaska Native blood they're also allowed to be members too. So I'm just confused about there's a huge range of policies of different tribes. So for the for this purpose, you need to have the comply with the federal rules around the quarter blood quantum.
Through the chair, Representative Lincoln, in the compact, Indian is defined correct through the federal definition that is in ICWA, and that is how we define Indian child as well. But we also do recognize in the compact through the different scopes of work, how a tribe or tribal organization defines its service population will also play into the different services that they can provide. And it is permissible, just so the committee is aware, that you can have a child enroll to two different tribes if the parents come from two different tribes and the tribes allow dual enrollment. Not all tribes in Alaska allow dual enrollment. Some require the parents to choose a tribe to enroll the child in. As for non-Native enrollment, that is a little bit of a gray area for a lot of tribes. And when they do accept or adopt a non-Native into the tribe, it's a lot of times for ceremonial purposes and for public recognition, but not necessarily for the delivery of services and programs.
Please continue.
Thank you very much. So the compact, how it accomplishes the purpose in which tribes will begin to deliver services and supports that have primarily been delivered by the Office of Children's Services throughout the years, is through the service support funding agreement process. The compact itself is just an overarching umbrella agreement between the state of Alaska and the different tribal co-signers. There are several sections of the compact, as you can see on this next slide. There are 11 sections total, all the way from purposes and definitions, which the representative from Kotzebue asked a very good question about. Article 3 lays out the authority for the state of Alaska to enter into this compact with the different signatory co-signers. And Article 6 and 7 is where we really think the rubber meets the road. Article 6 talks about the different sharing of services and supports between the state and the tribal co-signers that will happen without the exchange of funding per se. And Article 7 talks about the different services that the tribes will begin to assume once they negotiate a funding agreement with the state.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you for being here, Nicole. Would it strengthen any of this to put to codify any of these provisions statute?
Definitely. Thank you very much, Speaker Edgman, through the chair. Anytime you can codify a regulation or policy through statute, it does become a lot stronger. And we do think there's an opportunity to do that down the line, absolutely. We're in the early stages of implementing the compact. So we're working out some bugs, so to speak, because when you are, as I said, on the edge of law and policy, we're not operating in an environment of perfection. But one of the things that all of the co-signers in the state committed to at the outset is that we weren't going to let perfection be the enemy of good. So we're I don't want to speak for the state or for any of the tribal co-signers, but it might be a little bit early to think about codifying the compact as is right now, but definitely something to consider for the future. Thank you. Okay. This is a list of all of the different tribal co-signers. Sure, I'm not going to read it for you here. There are 18. The really important piece of information, though, that we hope the committee takes away from this is that 161 tribes are served and or affected by this compact. So this has an incredible reach throughout the state of Alaska. The previous witness testified earlier, Ms. Giroux, that there are 229 federally recognized tribes in Alaska. That is almost half of the United States population. So we have an incredible opportunity to really take what we're doing here and change the way that Indian country implements child welfare services. And we're really, really excited about that. And I also want to underscore the negotiation process, too, as it relates to how the compact came together that Director Norberg touched on. This has been, you know, quarter century decades in the making. And we're sitting here today as two lucky individuals that were able to be a part of that process. As you saw on the compact, we're not going to list out all the people that were involved in this, but people from across the state. From Uktiavik all the way down to Juneau, the folks on the compact and many more dedicated an entire year of their lives, and not just those of us that you saw in the video, but our families, oftentimes our spouses and our parents, that they were stepping in, raising our kids while we were negotiating this throughout long summer months. People gave up subsistence, paid time off, major milestones in their lives because we had a shot here and a window of opportunity to make this happen. So we do want to recognize everyone who's been a part of this. The negotiation process was quite long. Each of the tribal co-signers and tribes committed to having two representatives at the negotiation table, one of which had to have decision-making authority because decisions were happening in very short order, and the other one had to be a subject matter expert in the area of child welfare. They were a package duo, and physical attendance was required at every single negotiation because we did not have the opportunity to go back and open items that had been closed before. So it was really an incredible, intense effort, and we want to commend everyone that had been a part of this effort.
Ms. Romeo, did you say that it was a 10-month negotiation time frame?
Just the negotiation for the 40-page compact, yes. And over 20 attorneys worked on drafting the compact. It was a very collaborative effort between the State of Alaska Department of Law. A couple of attorneys that I do want to mention by name are Carla Erickson and Stacey Crayley, who have just been phenomenal. And they're very well respected in the Native community.
Thank you.
So now for the timeline of the implementation. So the compact was signed and went into effect in December of 2017, which was just roughly halfway through fiscal year 18. And so during that first fiscal year, we spent time really developing and building the infrastructure to be able to implement the first scope of work. So the first scope of work that was implemented was the initial diligent relative search scope, which means that the co-signers who signed on for that particular scope are searching for relatives for children who come into the foster care system. There is a federal requirement and state requirements as well that require that all relatives be identified and notified within 30 days of a child coming into care. And so the co-signers are doing that work for the Office of Children's Services. And what's very unique about this is that they have direct access to our online filing system, our ORCA system, and so they're actually entering the work on our behalf. And so when the work is done, it's done, versus other sort of contract or grant relationships where, you know, a service provider might provide some work, but in order for it to get documented and credited, it has to be subsequently entered into the system by an OCS caseworker.
Ms. Norberg, so can you explain again who has direct access to the online filing system? Is it the tribe?
Representative Zulkowski, that is correct, yes.
And if I may, Chairman Zulkowski, it's in a little bit more elaborate process than that. The tribal co-signers and tribes just can't log on to the state system. There are confidentiality agreements in place and other means to secure that the information is going to remain private.
That is part of the overarching impact of the compact, is that all of the confidentiality agreements that go in place. So again, the compact itself is this overarching document that puts in place those kinds of agreements around confidentiality and how information will be shared. And then underneath the compact are the scopes of work. And currently we have been very busy negotiating five different scopes of work. This year, the current year that we're in, we've implemented the diligent relative search. We have two more scopes ready to go, and we anticipate getting those online very soon. And then if we're allowed to move forward with the compact in FY20, we will be implementing two additional scopes of work.
Representative Edgman?
So that last statement caught my attention, if we're allowed to continue the compact in FY20. Can either one of you elaborate on that?
Representative Edgman, through the chair. The governor's office is still evaluating the compact, and so we're moving forward with the anticipation and cautiously optimistic that we'll be moving forward, but we have not received the ultimate. There has not been a decision yet. There's been a lot of things on the administration's plate at this point to look into, and so this is a piece of work that is still being investigated and looked into, and we hope to get this. We hope to be able to move forward soon.
Follow up.
So, can you talk a little bit more about the timeline? Is there sort of a point where you go past that time that this compact may be nullified or something?
There are negotiation meetings scheduled for mid-May, and so we're definitely hopeful that those will be able to continue. Other than that, I don't know that we have a timeline.
Through the chair, Speaker Edgman, the last round of scopes are effective through the end of fiscal year 19. So if we do not bring on new scopes of work July 1 of this year for fiscal year 20, we will need to begin the wind down process. The compact does specify how that would happen as well. It won't be an overnight type of thing. So July 2, the services and programs will not be transferred immediately back to the state, because that would not be in the best interest of the tribes or the children that they're serving. But we will have to begin that process if the governor's office doesn't make up a decision on whether or not this is going to continue by then.
And a follow-up question to Representative Edgman's line of questions. One conversation that we've had as it relates to compacting is, it's important as tribes begin to assume some of this collaborative work in partnership with the state, that there are resources that follow that expansion of partnership and expansion of work together. Is, as you describe what's been authorized through FY19, is that tied to financial support from the state in an effort to leverage the compact with the tribes? Is some of it, is some of it related to a continuation of funding support for the compact, or how does that play into some of the decision making?
Representative Zulkowski, our understanding is that the funds for the compact, which at this point are very minimal, are there. It's more of a policy decision for the governor at this time.
Representative Edgman?
So in essence, it's almost a ministerial type of exercise, right? The decision is made whether to continue the compact without having to bring the team back together or engage the Department of Law attorneys or what have you. It is, I think you just said, a policy call that the governor's office will make.
Speaker Edgman, you're correct. To the chair.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Borromeo, for presentation too. I know you're not done. Just a question came to mind earlier. The data point was shared that there's about 1,900 Alaska Native youth in state custody. So with the state tribal compact, are there enough resources within the tribal community to take all the 1,900 children that are in kind of widely dispersed throughout the system, or is there still anticipated it seems like foster care parents are so hard to come by and recruit in the first place. I'm just wondering what the system capacity is to effectively carry out this compact. I guess that's my question.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, the short answer is no. There is not enough capacity right now in terms of labor and funding for tribes and tribal organizations that have signed on to the compact to fully assume all of this work. A lot more funding is going to need to be poured into the compact. And I overlooked a very important piece of the presentation before that might help you better understand the type of services and supports that the tribes are looking to take over. Those are, as I mentioned before, outlined in Article 7, and some of them are up here online because these are the ones that the state, together with the co-signers, have said these are the most important ones for us to take on initially. But the other ones, in total, they are intake and decisions on protective service reports, initial assessments, diligent relative search, and ICWA preference searches, which is already on here, in-home case management, safety evaluations of unlicensed relatives, initial licensing, renewal, and support, out-of-home case management, caseworker visits with children, parents, and caregivers, family contact, transportation, and adoption and guardianship home studies. So that's a very expansive list, and a lot more state resources will need to come into this. But as my colleague here mentioned before, through the Title IV-E program, tribes draw down at a much higher rate than the state does when it comes to federal reimbursement. So our foster care system and our child welfare system is primarily funded through Title IV-E. And when the state is reimbursed, they're only reimbursed at, Natalie, what's the rate the state's reimbursed at?
Approximately 30%.
Okay, and the tribes will receive?
It varies tribe to tribe, but it's significantly more than that.
Mm-hmm. So another reason that we've done this hard work, and we'll get to this slide later, is that this is actually going to be more cost efficient and effective for the state long run. But there will need to be some dedication of state resources in order for the tribes to leverage what they're already doing. And mind you, these co-signers are masters when it comes to leveraging resources amongst each other and resources from the federal government.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more follow-up.
Please continue.
Yes, thank you. So what is the clearly we need more, you know, support for the foster care system, and in particularly for the state tribal compact. What's kind of the triage decision-making if there is, you know, you go through these decision-making points, but there's not a resource to place a child in a relative's home or in a tribe or in another Indian family? At what point is that kind of figured out? At what point a child can go into the larger foster care system? My guess is that's been all worked out in the compact rather than just stay kind of unplaced, I guess is what I'm saying.
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, not placing a child that needs to be removed is not an option, but I'm going to let Director Norberg answer that question because this is definitely her field, and while I could, I don't want to speak for her.
Thank you.
So the decision regarding placement, of course, has to happen right away, and we, the Office of Children's Services, attempts to notify the child's tribe immediately when we even go out on an investigation so that they are brought in as soon as possible and are helping in that process to identify potential relatives. In the event that a relative cannot be found in the immediate sense, then the child will be placed in stranger foster care. But our intention is to continue to search until we find a relative that will take the child up until the very end of the case. So that search process is ongoing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please continue. Thank you. One last thing that I'll add on that previous slide is that through the different scopes of works that are negotiated, even if a cosigner participates in the negotiation process, they are not required to sign on and assume that scope of work. So if they bring that scope of work back to their tribal chairman and council, and the tribe then convenes a meeting and says, we're just not able to take on family contact work right now, the cosigner is not obligated to take on that. And then we have different mechanisms for how that funding that had been earmarked, if you would, for that tribe will go and serve the other cosigners or roll back to the state. So that's another important piece here of the compact negotiation process. As I mentioned before, in terms of leveraging resources, one of the great ways that we've been able to do that so far is through public-private partnerships. And it's important that we recognize Casey Family Programs at this point. They are a national organization focused on child welfare and foster care. They have had a dedicated presence in the state for almost the last 20 years. They came into our negotiation process right at the outset and provided some seed money for the negotiations to get started, and they have continued to support this process through both their technical assistance and financial giving as well to make sure that we're incorporating national best practices into the compact. A lot of the, you know, this work has been done in other fields, so we're not looking to reinvent the wheel. We are looking to, again, leverage the resources that are already out there so that we can streamline the funding that comes from the state and other entities into grassroots, boots on the ground services for Alaska children.
Representative Edgman.
A few things are catching my ear here. Really great presentation. Streamline the resources, or OCS. Can you talk a little bit about what that might mean, sort of projecting into the future, with, assuming this compact stays intact?
Sure. Through the chair, Speaker Edgman, what we would like to see essentially is child welfare workers in region working faster, stronger, quicker. And a lot of times when you have a tribal organization or tribe that is intimately familiar with the child, they will be able to know off the top of their head, so to speak, who the aunt is, who the grandparents are. They're not going to have to spend a week or so Googling or calling random folks throughout the region to try and figure out, you know, if there's a case of emergency removal, where this child should go. So that's just one example of how resources will be saved. Also, transportation costs. If there needs to be a removal again and the state has to find a safe home, Director Norberg isn't going to have to dispatch someone from her field office to go to some of these smaller villages at great expense to the state of Alaska. Instead, her team can pick up the phone, call one of the, or send an email to one of the cosigners and say, can you please go assess these homes? And the tribal or tribe's workers will be able to do that.
Just to follow. So, you know, you can't help but sort of be in awe almost of how significant this compact could be. If you have any sense of understanding how strapped, over-taxed OCS workers are, they're understaffed, they have too many communities to deal with, caseloads, and it's not just rural Alaska, it's in urban Alaska as well. Mm-hmm. So just as this conversation continues, it's certainly not lost on me that the potential of this compact is maybe larger than what we've even realized today.
Through the chair, Speaker Edgman, exactly. It really is. It's exciting, the potential to really change the outcome of our children is now. And we understand and appreciate that we are at a difficult position in terms of where we're at with the state budget and the resources and revenue that are pouring into the state. But we hope that this committee will be able to impress upon your colleagues in both chambers how important that this work is as well, because like we said on the compact video, we be able to look back at this time and say this is when it really changed. And we're not asking for an exorbitant amount of resources, but some are going to have to be carved out for this process if we're going to get to where we know we can get.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, to me, this is exciting because I think it's directly relevant to state tribal education compacts, which is something I'm, and many others are very committed to pursuing, and I'm hoping this can be a model for how that can come together. We have a number of tribes that want to press forward, and I'm certainly hoping we can have a successful compact here as a model of how that can work going forward, because that the education compacts are also about taking care of Alaska's kids and Alaska Native children in particular. So we need to stay committed, stay the course. Thank you for that, Liberty.
Please continue.
So in conclusion, our long-term vision for the state is very positive. We want Alaskan children and families served locally as close to home as possible. And when we use the words tribes and tribal organizations, if that's uncomfortable and maybe a little too hard to wrap your head around, just replace those words with local. That's really what this is about, because in a lot of these small villages, the tribal governments are the only governments. The local governments are dormant because they don't have the resources right now to serve their populations. So this is about local control, really. Again, we want to see services delivered in the most cost-effective and efficient manner possible. The state is committed to that as well. Director Norberg keenly understands this, as does her staff. And we want to supplement each other's work. You know, this is a reciprocal relationship. This is not a one-way street. A strong OCS is a stronger Alaska for us. We want to stop the repetitive abusive behaviors within the state. That is something that Director Norberg identified earlier on. Alaska Native children have much higher rates of maltreatment, repetitive maltreatment, two times as much. That needs to end. And finally, we want to see outcomes for Alaskan children improved. Native, non-native, it doesn't matter. Alaskan children deserve the best future possible, and we know that we can get there with your help. So thank you very much for your time and attention. We're happy to answer any more questions. And again, we really are privileged to do this work. I know that Natalie feels the same way. We're just the lucky ones that get to be here with you today. Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question from a constituent that you may or may not have this information, but we can't help but notice that there could be a possible correlation with a high percentage of Alaska Natives in our prison system. And this friend has wondered if part of it is due to such maltreatment, a high percentage of children, Alaska Native children in our foster care. Do you know if there's any correlation with this? Because this gives me hope that perhaps we will be addressing another large issue in our state by starting at the beginning. Is this something that you can speak to?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, they're all related. I don't have any hard data, but anecdotally, yes, if a child has a tougher beginning, the chances that they're going to be a productive member contributing to society are much less. And I'll give you an analogy that the current Senate president shared the first time that we did a presentation to this body. We were talking about the compact, and she had a very keen observation, which is that what the compact hopes to do is not wait until a child is floating down the stream and drowning. What she saw the compact is doing is putting the life vest on the child, telling them to stay away from the river so they never end up there. And that's really what we want to do. And long term, our child welfare system is going to look a little bit different. The tribes and tribal organizations are very focused on prevention versus intervention. And we understand that the state's model is intervention because because that's what's needed right now. But long term, we both hope to focus on more preventative services and supports that will keep families intact. And we have to address the elephant in the room, which is poverty. There is a major disparity between quality of life in rural Alaska and urban Alaska, and even some pockets of rural urban Alaska. So this is a broader conversation, but you're absolutely right, Representative Vance. These are related variables for sure.
Thank you.
So this is a question for Director Norberg. Out of curiosity, because the area of compacting with tribes in the area of child welfare has sort of blazed a trail in Alaska in a way that it hasn't to this point, stemming from this work, particularly in the area of child welfare, have there been additional agreements that have developed from this initial compacting structure for expanded regional services in other parts of Alaska?
Madam Chair, I am not aware of any other agreements that have resulted as a result of this, but we can certainly explore that and get back to you.
Okay, that would be great. I ask only because I know that the Norton Sound region has been very involved in this work as well, and we couldn't bring our president from Cowerick. She was unable to join us today, but we know that they've done a lot of advocacy, and we would just love to hear about any additional models that have been productive based on the work that you all have done.
Madam Chair, if I can capitalize on a remark that Representative Kopp made earlier, we have begun discussions with the state in different areas, and education is one of them. Another potential possibility that we see as compactable is certain functions of the correction system. So I know that's not directly related to your question on a regional basis, but we think statewide and big all of the time. So we definitely think that there's more opportunities there. Education is going to be quite different, though, because instead of, you know, a two-party negotiation system as this was between the state and tribal co-signers, the education system has school boards and parents. So the conversation is going to have to be framed much differently. And I'd be remiss if we didn't mention the work of First Alaskans in this process, and I should have at the beginning. So I want to take just a brief moment to recognize Elizabeth Medicine Crow, who's the president of that organization, and her work in really setting the table to have some tough conversations around child welfare in this state, because if the state wasn't able to sit down with the Native community and get through some of these tougher conversations, we would not have been able to negotiate this. So that was an incredible amount of work that organization did, and the state as well in the process.
Thank you, Nicole. That is a very important recognition to make.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Well, I just, before we let you go, I just want to say, Brianna, both for your time here with us today, but also in the years that has taken to get us to this point to be able to have you come in and talk about the successes of this work. One of the focuses of this committee has been to explore opportunities for compacting. We know that these conversations have been happening in different areas of different departments of the state, and we wanted to be able to pull together and work from a shared foundation of knowledge from which to have those conversations. And in our early committee hearings have been having discussions about compacting, areas of opportunity for increased and improved contracting and consultation within state government. We know that there's a wide spectrum of capacity, that it doesn't always have to begin at compacting, that sometimes it just can begin at meaningful ongoing consultation in terms of relationship building, but can absolutely, as seen in this opportunity, step into areas of compacting with tribes. As was mentioned at the beginning of your presentation, this is definitely a historic moment, and I just want to make sure that we take the time as a committee to recognize that. I sincerely appreciate, I won't speak for my committee members, but I think you've heard consensus among us on this particular issue. Recognizing the incredible work that has gone into this compact, it is clearly a labor of love, not just for the tribes and the tribal co-signers, but of course with the Office of Children's Services. I think it's been mentioned on a number of occasions by our committee members today that we are absolutely in a moment of having to find transformational solutions, and I believe this is just one great example, and we so appreciate the work that you've done and look forward to ongoing conversations around where we can benefit in other areas of our state. So thank you. All right, that brings us to the end of our business today. Next Tuesday, March 26th at 8 a.m., we will be hearing presentations on tribal partnerships and additional success stories from rural Alaska. The time is 9:28 a.m., and this hearing of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs is now adjourned.